Hi everyone, and welcome to my show called We Were Lied To About 9/11. I am your host, John Gold, and this show is part of the Soapbox People's Network. This week, we're going to talk about the inhumanity of Guantanamo Bay. We're also going to talk about how there can be no justice found at the military commissions, not for the 9/11 families or anyone affected by that day. This might be harsh, but in my opinion, anyone who says justice can be found at Gitmo is either lying or just plain ignorant.
Hi, this is John, and I'm here with Andy Worthington. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, John. How are you?
I'm doing the best I can.
Good.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to read your bio for everyone, and then we'll get started. Andy Worthington is a freelance investigative journalist, activist, author, photographer, filmmaker, and singer-songwriter. He is the co-founder of the Close Guantanamo campaign, the director of We Stand With Shaker, calling for the immediate release of Guantanamo of Shakir Amir, I guess that's how you say that, the last British resident in the prison, and the author of the Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, published by Pluto Press, distributed by Macmillan in the U.S., and it's also available on Amazon. And of two other books, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion of the Battle of Bean Field, the books are Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Bean Field. He is also the co-director with Polly Nash of the documentary film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. He has written for the New York Times and The Guardian and is currently writing for Al Jazeera. He has also worked with the United Nations, WikiLeaks, and Reprieve. Would you like me to reread that?
It's fine, John. Don't worry. It was close to that.
Sure?
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, so we'll get to the questions. The first question is, what was the day of 9/11 like for you?
Well, you know, I was working at home, doing some writing, and then my wife was suddenly shouting at me, Andy, you've got to come and see what's happening. And, so then, like everybody else, I came down and watched the TV and saw these terrible things happening. So, that was my experience of it. I mean, I was obviously, a long way from it, but as shocked as everybody was, I think, really.
Right. So it was a complete shock to you. Okay. It was to most people as well. The next question is, what was the first thing you questioned about 9/11, if anything?
Okay, well, my memories of that time, John, and it's such a long time ago now, but my memories are that I remember thinking quite soon after it, as I think many people did outside the United States, I'm not sure what the feeling was within the U.S., that this appeared, although this was an attack on a huge scale and with an intention of really, really making an impact. And we didn't know what was going on. I remember feeling that this was some sort of attack on the United States for some element of its foreign policy that I didn't know about at the time, but it felt that that's what it was. That it was somebody who objected strenuously to some aspect of U.S. policy in one of the many countries abroad where there was perceived interference and a military presence. So it's funny actually thinking back to what we knew and what we didn't know at the time and who it may have been, because we're now so used to the terrorist narrative and the terrorist agenda that we've had, pushed for 13 years now, that it's difficult to remember a time that didn't exist, I suppose.
Right. Well, you and I have had discussions in the past about questions that I have, trying to convince you of this, that, and the other thing. And I'm just curious, do you question more today, like the legitimacy of the 9/11 Commission, perhaps?
Well, I don't necessarily believe that they were, that they were empowered to get to the truth, but I still believe the narrative that I suppose fundamentally the book that I recommend people to read to discuss the build up to 9/11, or one of the books, is The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright, which I think lays out very clearly how the main problem in the run up to 9/11, which was a terrorist attack, was that the FBI and the CIA were not communicating with each other, and that clues that both sides should have been sharing, they weren't. But there are many reasons why I cannot attribute sufficient competence to the Bush administration to have been able to manage to do something that was an inside job themselves. I also been pretty persuaded over the years by people close to Dick Cheney talking about how he fundamentally changed after those attacks, how he became a noticeably colder and harder person. This is people who count themselves among his friends, and that's never really seemed to me something that could be put on. So, I still, I'm afraid, have to disagree with you, John. We have to agree to differ. That that my understanding of this is that the people who were in charge, I think, were dangerous people to have in charge. They were going to horribly overreact, which they did, and they were going to use it as an opportunity to push their own agendas. I mean, one of the things that I remember being shocked by reading Jane Mayer's book a few years ago was how British intelligence people happened to be in the Pentagon and the on the day of the 9/11 attacks, and how absolutely shocked they were that all these people were running around going, "Great, now we can invade Iraq," and they were just in deep shock, thinking, "Iraq? What the hell has
Right.
Iraq got to do with this?"
Right, I remember.
And just one example of the kind of the kind of, and of course, later on, these British intelligence people, if they were in their jobs, would be swept up in the Tony Blair-driven drive to join the United States in their absolutely illegal and unjustified attack on Iraq, which, as we now see, I think, John, has been a disaster in almost every way that it could have been.
All right, well, we'll have to agree to disagree. I don't want to get into a debate with you, but what I do recommend is that you listen to the first 21 shows that I've had.
Okay,
Okay.
John.
When was Gitmo opened, and what was its purpose?
Okay, well, Guantanamo opened on January the 11th, 2002, so exactly 4 months after 9/11. Its purpose was as a place where the existing laws and treaties governing the treatment of prisoners could be bypassed by the United States, and of course, the only reason that you would want to bypass the protections on prisoners is so that you can do things to them that you're not allowed to do. So I think it's reasonable to conclude that not only was it intended to bypass all of these laws and treaties governing the treatment of prisoners, that was done so that these people could be tortured or subjected to other forms of abuse that are not allowed. And actually, if we look back on the history of the period, John, what we see is that it opened on January 11th, 2002. Lawyers from the beginning tried to hold the Bush administration to the existing standards of how you treat prisoners. But it took almost 2.5 years to get to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said that they had habeas corpus rights and that lawyers had to be allowed in to see them. And it took until June 2006 in another Supreme Court ruling, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, for the Supreme Court to point out to the Bush administration that it didn't matter, you know, how you tried to dress people up who were your captives. All of them were entitled to the protections, the baseline protections of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits torture and other forms of abuse. So, you know, we are in the situation, looking back, on people needing to understand that for a 4.5 year period, the United States, the government of the United States claimed that it didn't have to treat people that it was depriving of their liberty in a humane manner. You know, that's the bottom line of it. That's really pretty disgusting.
Yes.
But as we've also seen, John, of course, no one has been held accountable for that.
No one has been held accountable with regards to a lot of things. And
yeah, absolutely.
You know, didn't they refer to them as enemy combatants, which therefore, you know, they weren't qualified for the Geneva Conventions and so forth?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was, you know, they claimed that there was a category of unprivileged belligerents, another version of it, who didn't have the protections. And, you know, that's why I feel it's so important to keep pointing out that eventually when the Supreme Court, you know, handed down a ruling on this, they pointed out to the administration that there isn't a category of person who has no rights. Everybody has the right not to be tortured or treated otherwise in an abusive manner. And the Bush administration had, you know, deliberately decided that that this wasn't the case and had, you know, come up with slippery legal decisions about why they should be entitled to do this, which, you know, was not acceptable. But it was something that they insisted on for all of this time. And, you know, and when we look at why they were doing that, what they were trying to do, you know, again, I think it's quite shocking, really. I think the most prevalent aspect of what they were trying to do involves an intelligence policy called the mosaic theory, which is that if you have a whole bunch of people who appear to know nothing or not very much, then you know, the theory is that if you keep on interrogating these people, you get them to provide little bits and pieces of information, which when you put those together with little bits and pieces of information from all these other people, will build up to some coherent whole that will enable you to make some kind of intelligence breakthrough. I think it's, you know, I think it's completely unfounded as a theory, but it also, I think, enables people hopefully to see the potential scale of things, you know, which wasn't fully realized. But, you know, if you take the mosaic theory to its logical conclusion, they could have rounded up pretty much everybody that they found in Afghanistan and in neighboring countries on the theory that they were Muslims who may have some kind of knowledge that would help them to understand what the threat that they faced was. But, you know, as it turned out, it was a much smaller number of people, but they had this notion that, that you know, any small amount of information could be useful. And that to get that, they were perfectly willing to try and justify holding people for years, for decades, possibly forever. You know, it's really just really quite extraordinary when, you know, if you think that a trained interrogator, for example, trained to build a rapport with a suspect and to try and get information in that manner, wouldn't recognize any of this as being, you know, even at all practical or useful.
Well, it's common knowledge that torture does not work as a means of getting information. And from what I understand, a lot of the torture that took place was to get information that helped the Bush administration make their case for war in a lot of cases. And you know, it wasn't accurate. And I remember hearing stories about how Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would, quote, make up stories, end quote, to get them to stop torturing him.
Right. Well, I think it was more particularly Abu Zubaydah who did that. I think the feeling with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is that he, you know, gave them less. That Abu Zubaydah gave them a lot more. But certainly, you know what you're saying is absolutely true. I mean, you can get information out of people using torture, but you don't get accurate information. Or to be strictly correct about it, you may get some accurate information, but you will also get an untold amount of inaccurate information, and you then have to spend time following up all the leads to try and find out what's real and what isn't. And I remember years ago reading the FBI's director, actually, who spoke to a journalist and who was quoted in an article in, I think, Vanity Fair, saying, you know, that basically, you know, the FBI had its resources given over for a huge amount of, you know, for a significant amount of time to, you know, a whole succession of wild goose chases, which were all the result of the lies that poor old Abu Zubaydah was coming up with while he was being tortured. You know, it was a complete waste of time. But, you know, they were told to follow up all of these, you know, red-hot leads that had come from the guy who was giving up this useful information, and none of it was.
Wasn't it reported that Abu Zubaydah did not have the connections to Al-Qaeda that we were originally led to believe?
Oh, absolutely, John. Yeah, I mean, this is something that has steadily emerged over the years. I think it was in 2009, if I recall correctly, that the government was first filing legal documents, walking back from the claims that had been made, the grandiose claims that had been made, in the early days. When, you know, I'm not entirely sure who was lying and exaggerating and distorting and for what effect. I certainly know that it was reported that, you know, Bush was told that Abu Zubaydah was significant. Then it was told by, I think, George Tenet that he wasn't and, you know, and didn't want to lose face. I know that FBI operatives are on record as saying that even before he was apprehended, people should have known who he was, that he was connected to a training camp, but not one that had anything to do with Al-Qaeda, that he was not somebody who would be trusted with any detailed information about anything sensitive because, as they said, the guy was always on the phone. I think that's almost a verbatim quote. He obviously used his cell phone a lot. He was obviously a bit of a blabbermouth. It's not really what you want if you're dealing with sensitive, you know, major terrorist operations that clearly are only going to work if you have the smallest number of people involved. So, you know, and on we go, really, John. The stories, you know, they build up as to how it should have been apparent that he really wasn't who they said he was. They said he was the number three in Al-Qaeda. They ended up eventually, as I say, in this legal document in 2009 saying, okay, he wasn't Al-Qaeda. Okay, he didn't probably know anything about 9/11 before it happened. And on, walking back from almost everything, but then trying to claim that he was in charge of some militia after the 9/11 attacks, after the US-led invasion, which somehow was engaged in US forces. I don't think there's a shred of truth in that either. I think as a facilitator, what Abu Zubaydah did was that he helped a lot of people out of Afghanistan, and he helped a lot of people across the board, men, women, and children, civilians as well as combatants. You know, I don't see that makes him anything that he's been dressed up to be. But of course, you know, this is a guy who, as we understand from the limited information that has been able to be uttered by his lawyers, who are, you know, technically prohibited from mentioning a word about him, have said that this is a guy who regularly suffers seizures, that he is, you know, pretty destroyed by what's happened to him. It has never been the person that they said he was.
Right. What are some of the reported tortures that have taken place at Gitmo? Besides the forced feeding and so forth, what we found out recently, the rectal feeding, and that's all considered torture in my book. But what are some of the reported tortures that have taken place?
Yeah, well, the rectal feeding, which was a specific CIA thing at some point. I mean, that was disgusting, wasn't it? You know, yeah. I mean, I've been studying this for years. You've been reading about all this for years. You know, that was one new fact that emerged where I just felt a bit sick, to be honest.
I honestly didn't know you could do that.
What, feel sick?
I didn't know that you could feed someone rectally.
Oh, no. Well, I think it takes a particularly sadistic, you know, turn of mind to contemplate it in the first place. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, this is the thing, John, is that there have been certain aspects of the torture program, perhaps certain aspects of the CIA program, that involved very, very clinical attempts to, you know, break people mentally, you know, a lot of which was derived from the military seer psychologists who were working, you know, for the government with the CIA, you know, trying to do things in an extremely controlled manner. Then there are obviously other aspects of it where, you know, where people who were inclined to sadism or were allowed to unleash their inner sadist were, you know, were given much more leeway about the kind of things that they should get up to do to people. You know, I think it runs the whole gamut of all of these things, the things that took place. You know, and it's still, I think it should shock people to realize how across the board it was, you know, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the black sites, in Guantanamo, the different forms of torture and abuse that took place. But, you know, you asked me specifically about Guantanamo. In Guantanamo, in the fall of 2002, the authorities had discovered that one of the men that they held was allegedly the elusive 20th hijacker for the 9/11 attacks, that he wasn't being cooperative, and so Donald Rumsfeld authorized a program of specific techniques to be used on him, and he then went through a period of months and months where he was subjected to 20-hour interrogations on a daily basis. So, you know, he was allowed very little sleep, was constantly woken up should he fall asleep during these 20-hour interrogations, when he was just, you know, just humiliated in all kinds of ways and threatened in other kinds of ways. So he was threatened with, you know, with the rape of his female relatives. He was threatened with being taken to another country where terrible things would happen to him. He was humiliated through having women's underwear put on his head, being made to bark like a dog, having pictures of naked women hung around his neck. I can't remember now specifically, John, but I would imagine there were female personnel who were also, you know, interfering with him because, you know, when they worked out that certain men were very susceptible to any kind of sexual issues, then they would prey on them for this. You know, the other kind of stuff that was introduced was just because, you know, the program that was tailored for him, elements of this were ones that then spread throughout Guantanamo, essentially. I don't think that they applied to everybody. I know that one person who spoke on the record about it said that it was one in six of the prisoners, which was about the height of the number of prisoners there. So it would be over 100 people who were subjected to this kind of isolation and forced nudity, extreme heat, extreme cold, very loud music, white noise, what they called the frequent flyer program, where they moved prisoners from cell to cell every few hours so they couldn't sleep, all of these kind of things.
Weren't some of the individuals that were brought to Guantanamo people that were picked up or handed over by, I guess, the Pakistanis or the Afghans, just, you know, to get a terrorist? Here's a terrorist, and then the U.S. would then pay them money for these people?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, they were paying, the average figure seems to be about $5,000 a head, which was being paid in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is a huge amount of money in those parts of the world. They were, you know, we've got to remember that they wanted Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So the shorthand for the war on terror and the prisoners that they've held at Guantanamo to this day is that they're all terrorists. You know, that's what the Republicans try and persuade the American public is going on. If you actually, you know, bother to spend a minute actually looking at the details of what's going on at Guantanamo, you'll find out that, you know, only a very, very small number of those men, a few percent, have ever actually been accused of terrorism. You know, most of what constitutes terrorism is that, you know, these hapless guys from the Middle East went to a training camp that was partly sponsored by Osama bin Laden. So every few months he would turn up and deliver a, you know, stirring speech to them, and they would see him from a distance. You know, and this is supposed to constitute, you know, terrorism. They were clearly all of these people, you know, who were at these training camps, for example, if they were there, because you know they may have been, it may have been lied about that they actually went to the camp. But even if they were, you know, pretty much all of these people were there in a military context. They were fighting the Northern Alliance, who were also Muslims, in an inter-Muslim civil war in Afghanistan that was going on, you know, in its own dreadful manner, you know, until suddenly 9/11 took place, and then the U.S. invaded, and then suddenly everybody who was in Afghanistan on that at that moment, the 6th, 7th of October 2001, suddenly became an enemy of the United States. And not only, not actually even an enemy in a military context, but they all became effectively terrorists if they happened to fall into the U.S. hands or were sold to them. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't like to say, John, that, you know, the exact numbers of them that were soldiers and the exact numbers of them that were completely innocent people in the wrong place at the wrong time. There were, I think, it's fair to say, hundreds of people in Guantanamo. I would say a couple of hundred is, you know, perhaps accurate, of people who had absolutely nothing to do with anything. I mean, you know, there were numerous house raids in Pakistan in the first half of 2002, based on what I could only describe as tragically inept intelligence. If that was the case, it may just have been that the Pakistanis were trying to keep the Americans sweet, so they were just, you know, coming up with all kinds of rubbish as to, you know, where the terrorists were hiding out, and, you know, all manner of, you know, bearded Muslim gentlemen who were there as office workers and teachers and all kinds of things were swept up and sent to Guantanamo. You know, and there were clearly people who were missionaries.
That's so interesting.
There were people who were missionaries and humanitarian aid workers, for example. But yeah, sorry, go on, John.
I was just going to say that's so infuriating to me. And, you know, people look at Afghanistan as the quote-unquote good war. But I still, for the crime of 9/11, don't see how you can hold an entire country accountable for the actions of a few.
No.
And within the last 2 years, I think Joe Biden referred to the Taliban as our friends, actually.
right.
But anyway.
The only thing that would have been acceptable, you know, at the time, I think, was that, you know, the United States and its coalition partners. I mean, you know, I think the legality of it all is still a bit shady. But let's say that we accept the notion that some response in that part of the world was acceptable. Then it would have been to go after Al Qaeda, and, you know, and even stretching it, that what the U.S. was determined to do was also to topple the Taliban government. But, you know, there is a great book by Anand Gopal, which I, you know, recommend for people to read. It's heartbreaking. It's a book called No Good Men Among the Living: America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. It, you know, Anand spent several years as a reporter in Afghanistan. You know, and he's looking at what happened in Afghanistan and how tragically inept everything was. And his perspective, you know, and I mean, when I met him, he explained it to me very succinctly. He said, it is almost unbelievable how the United States snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. He said, look, by early 2002, they'd actually achieved what they wanted. Most of Al-Qaeda was captured, dead, or scattered, and the Taliban government had been toppled. And yet, what happened? The United States stayed. And what did they do when they stayed? They had no idea what they were doing. So they're, you know, they're still tooled up and angry, and, you know, and they didn't, had no idea who to trust, and they were played by, you know, by one disreputable warlord after another, and just mired themselves in a disaster of their own making. And, you know, and the last group of prisoners who arrived in Guantanamo, mostly Afghans, in the last half of 2002 and into most of 2003, when they stopped sending people there for the most part, were just Afghan nobodies. So, you know, one after another were caught up in some feud in Afghanistan, where, you know, the United States had been, you know, used to play the role of jailer. It was absolutely disgraceful. And when you think that what happened then is that they stopped sending people to Afghanistan, but they started piling them up in Bagram, thousands of them, the same incompetence was displayed across the board. And my God, what a way to lose hearts and minds, to be, you know, repeatedly imprisoning the wrong people. And not just that, but imprisoning them without any form of due process, you know, for over a decade, of course, in terms of Guantanamo. But, you know, it was typical in Bagram for people to be held for 18 months or 2 years before anybody bothered to even, you know, give them a cursory review to find out whether they had the right people or not. I mean, just,
well,
you know,
that's
you
one of the points.
You couldn't create a better template for losing hearts and minds.
That's one of the things that I bring up a lot, is the fact that if our leaders honestly thought that our actions in that region would not stir up anger out of people, or would not create thoughts of retaliation against the United States, they're absolutely morons.
Yeah.
It's a perpetual war. When you kill somebody, you have a family, their family, who suddenly hates the United States and wants to retaliate. It's a never-ending process. And one of the things that was a surprise to me, at one time there was a poll taken that showed 92% of Afghans had never even heard of 9/11.
You're right.
So, I mean, it's just absurd.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I mean, it absolutely is, John. But, you know, I mean, it's funny because, you know, we could look back on other disastrous American military adventures and, you know, and some of the same contours would be there. I mean, what the hell was Vietnam about? You know.
Right.
Unwinnable wars that really shouldn't have been embarked upon, you know, over and over again. But, you know, I mean, I really do, you know, wholeheartedly recommend Anand Gopal's book. It is heartbreaking. I mean, it is genuinely heartbreaking. You know, I would be surprised if people aren't in tears reading it, because, you know, it's so well expressed, the you know, losing when you should have won. I mean, it, you know, the limited aims of it were working, you know, and then it was all thrown away. And, you know, and here we are, a decade later, more than a decade later, still not able to disentangle from this thing properly, and you know,
well,
the ruin of everything.
Back in,
I mean,
power.
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, they would be, because, you know, because historically there are two things going on here. One is that, you know, that Afghanistan is the playground of Pakistan, you know, and you know, that's not something that's going to be easily addressed. But the other thing is that a lot of these people are actually Afghans. It's actually their country. You know, the problem with the neo-colonial projects, and believe me, I looked at this one in terms of Iraq particularly, but also Afghanistan with the British involvement, you know, and I've watched what our leaders in Britain have said about it, is they behave exactly like the colonial masters of the past, which is that they obviously think that these people are subhuman compared to them, you know, that they don't imagine for a minute if you know, the situation was reversed, and, you know, and a foreign hostile invader came and invaded the UK, you know, promising all kinds of wonderful things, but actually being a foreign invader occupying, you know, this land, of course people would rise up. You know, of course,
yes,
people would be saying, I'm not stopping until you guys are out of my country. Sorry, that's it. You know, how dare you? But it's the, you know, it's the persistent colonial, you know, mentality.
Right. And I've tried to make that comparison to people in the United States. What would you do if the United States was invaded by Canada? Would you just sit here and take it, or would you rise up? And, you know, you would rise up, and you would be considered a terrorist, you know, in the eyes of America. If you're looking at Afghanistan, the United States looks at them, the people who rise up, as terrorists. But we would be
right.
No different if someone invaded this country. So
how
many people have died at Gitmo?
10 people have died over the years. 9, I think, sorry. 9 people have died at Guantanamo. You know, I know there was a case where one man who tragically had, you know, he had been a huge supporter of the anti-Taliban movement in Afghanistan. He had helped to free from jail, from a Taliban jail, a handful of people, including somebody who was very prominent in the anti-Taliban post-US invasion government. He had helped these guys escape from a Taliban jail. The Taliban were then after him. He'd run away to Iran for quite some time. When he came back thinking that it might be safe for him to do so after the US-led invasion, he was then, through a terrible error or through being betrayed by somebody, ended up in U.S. custody. And, you know, the shocking thing is that over and over again, he told them what the story was, and they refused to believe him. And he died of cancer in Guantanamo. He was quite an old man. In Christmas 2007, 2006, 2007. And what I did was that I found out that Carl Otto Gall of the New York Times had met his son sometime before that and had come across the story. So I got in touch with Carl Otto, and we then wrote a front page story for the New York Times, which was published in February 2008. And within an hour, somebody in the Bush administration was on to the New York Times to say, "You shouldn't have employed this guy." They apologized publicly for giving me a byline on the front page because, quote, I had a point of view.
Well, I don't know how familiar you are with the New York Times and how well they work together with the government, but that's just,
yeah,
it's funny. I mean, it's absurd,
but, you know, that was
sad, but
it's a kind of badge of honor. I mean, the story happened and it's out there and people can find it, John, and it was a very powerful story, but he's the only one I know who died of natural causes. So the other eight guys all allegedly died by committing suicide. Now, did they?
Right.
Well, you know, there are obviously a number of question marks about. I think once you start to look at it, something very, very dark going on within Guantanamo, which of course is completely comprehensible, given the incredibly dark history of what's gone on in that place.
Well,
I don't doubt
that people would want to commit suicide in Guantanamo, but if
right.
they all committed suicide, it kind of becomes suspect.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it may be that some of these cases are straightforward, John. All I know is that over the years there have been, suggestions that that not all of those people who did commit suicide did actually commit suicide. And actually a lot of them were people who were strenuously resisting their oppression within the prison. So that already in itself starts to become a little bit suspicious. Would these guys really give up? I mean, one of the guys who allegedly committed suicide, I met a former prisoner, told me, oh yeah, this guy was, you know, this guy was just, he was very upset about the way they treated him. He couldn't stand the molestation, essentially, all the kind of sexual stuff that they did, profoundly depressed him. And I thought, yeah, here's this, you know, older guy who was just, you know, humiliated to the point where he couldn't stand it anymore. But the ones who were kind of younger and feistier, it's like, really? Really? They took their own lives? They looked like they were devoted to fighting this oppression. And I would recommend, you know, again, I would recommend people who are interested to read Murder in Camp Delta, which is Murder at Camp Delta by Joseph Hickman, which came out just 6 weeks ago. It's Joseph Hickman was a former staff sergeant at Guantanamo. He was in charge of the guard towers on the night that three prisoners allegedly died by committing suicide simultaneously.
They died,
you know,
one night? Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
they all
died
in
one night. Yeah, they did. And Joe Hickman, you know, was in a guard tower looking at the movement of people and from that basis couldn't accept the official story that these guys had killed themselves because it just didn't all add up. But I really recommend people who want to know more to go and look at that story, find out more about it. It's Joseph Hickman. Actually 5 years ago, Scott Horton wrote an article first about this in Harper's Magazine. It's taken 5 years for the book to come out. There was some coverage when it came out. There's a Democracy Now! Feature on it. There's a few other things. It's worth people to look at. The explanations, the official explanations are really not satisfactory. That's an understatement. But it is worth
people
who want
to know more
exploring this. Yeah.
I could relate
well,
to that
of course.
With regards to 9/11, but anyway.
Well, there you go, John.
How many people have been cleared to leave but are still being held there?
Well, there are...
I know I added...
Sorry.
I added right? that question.
That's all right, John. Don't worry. Yeah, there are 122 men still held at Guantanamo. So, you know, that's way down from the 779 who've been held there in total. You know, over 500 of them were released by President Bush. The rest have been released under President Obama. Of the 122 men still held, 55 of those 122 have been told by the U.S. administration, by the authorities, mostly 5 years ago, after an exhaustive high-level review process in the first year of Obama's presidency, first presidency, that the U.S. no longer wanted to hold them, and that, you know, arrangements would be made for them to be leaving. And they're all still there. So why is that, you may ask? And it's a good question. And there are two reasons in particular. One is that although President Obama has, you know, released a considerable number of people from Guantanamo, he ran up against opposition from Congress beginning in about 2010, when legislation was passed that created a bunch of hoops and hurdles for him to have to overcome to release prisoners. Now, he always had the power to do that, but he lacked the political will to engage in a fight with the Republicans, so he sat on his hands for a few years. After the prisoners went on a huge hunger strike that got the world suddenly remembering that Guantanamo was still there and was still a terrible place, he got a lot of criticism, you know, at all levels from all kinds of people and organizations and governments and bodies. And so he promised to, you know, get off his hands and start doing something. And he has been releasing prisoners while Congress is still trying to stop him from doing so. So that's been difficult. But the other reason is that most of these men are from Yemen. And, you know, it's if it's almost impossible to get out of Guantanamo for most people, then it's almost impossible to get out of Guantanamo if you're from the Yemen, if not actually impossible. From the Bush administration times onwards and throughout the Obama administration, or I should say since there was an underwear bomb plot around Christmas 2009, the entire U.S. establishment has been extremely unwilling to repatriate anyone from Yemen. You know, fearing that the security situation is so fragile in the country and the presence of Al-Qaeda there is so dangerous that they can't release anybody. Now, I think that kind of blanket ban on releasing people is completely unacceptable. It, you know, it constitutes a kind of guilt by nationality. And as I've said on my visits to the U.S., imagine if you know, a Californian is released from a prison in the United States on the mainland and goes on to commit some sort of crime. And then a bunch of lawmakers get together and say, what we need to do now is, you know, to prevent anyone from California ever being released from prison again. You know, that is a really, really far right-wing view of what would be possible for the prison system. And the justice system. And yet, when it comes to Guantanamo, this is apparently regarded as acceptable.
Well, what I've told people, with regards to the crime of 9/11, I've said that you can't blame entire nationalities, ideologies, or religions for the actions of a few. And it turns out that there's actually a term for that. It's called collective punishment. And it's a war crime. And it's against the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, well, no, collective punishment is exactly right, and that, you know, and that is what's happening with the guys from Yemen. The only good thing that's happened recently is that actually a handful of these guys have been found new homes in other countries. You know, because for years no one from Yemen was being released. So, you know, while the Obama administration is refusing to push for releasing them to their home country, they have been working to find other countries for them to be sent to. you know, which has meant that some of them at least are getting out there, because otherwise they were, I think, collectively feeling that, you know, this collective punishment that that you described was certainly being inflicted on them.
Right. Before I read the next question, I have a statement that was written by the September 11th advocates. It was released on November 19th, 2009, and it's in regards to AG Eric Holder's announcement on moving the 9/11 trials to New York City. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read this little statement.
Yeah.
For immediate release, November 19th, 2009. We are encouraged by Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement that the trial of alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four additional detainees, Waleed Muhammad, Salih Mubarak bin Attash, Ramzi bin Al-Shib, Ali Abdulaziz Ali, and Mustafa Ahmed Al-Hawassawi, would be moved to our federal court system in New York City. Unfortunately, this has evoked a knee-jerk reaction that has been brought to an almost feverish pitch by the media pundits and the politicians. This response seems to be agenda-driven rhetoric unsupported by facts. Fear-mongering is a tactic that is often used by those in power to hide wrongdoing. Perhaps those responsible for ordering torture have something to hide. Could those people be creating this frenzy? With the apparent desire to try these suspects in the military commission system, one would think that the success rate of prosecutions would be higher than that of the federal courts, but that is not the case. To date, the military commission system has had a very low success rate and has only brought one 9/11 terrorist case to completion. On the other hand, the American justice system has been used to try terrorists 214 times since September 11, 2001, with a success rate of 91%, 195 people were convicted. The one 9/11 related case that was brought to completion in the military commission system, U.S. versus Hamdan, brought Hamdan only a 66-month sentence. He was sent back to Yemen in January 2009. Where was the outrage then? In fact, having accused September 11th alleged terrorists on American soil in federal court is not precedent-setting. The alleged 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, was held in a Virginia detention center and was later sentenced in federal court, also located in Virginia. Where was the outcry at that time? During the course of that hearing, we fortunately did not experience a terrorist incident. Admittedly, an attempted attack could occur whether we try these suspects in America or Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Does that mean we should not try them at all? It should also be noted that the military commission system allows for secret proceedings where tainted evidence and hearsay could be used. Thus, any resulting verdict could lack credibility. For those who fear an attack because trials are being held on American soil, isn't it just as likely that a verdict lacking credibility could provoke an attack? Additionally, we believe the decision to try these men in our federal courts is less about giving detainees the same privileges as American citizens and more about America being a nation that conducts itself according to the rule of law. As a matter of practicality, in order to protect our citizens and soldiers around the world, it is best that we not devolve into barbarians seeking revenge. Retaliation then becomes an even greater risk. It is time that we actually look at the facts and stop reacting from a place of fear. Now, if you don't know, the September 11th advocates are also known as the Jersey Girls, the four women responsible for the creation of the 9/11 Commission. Do you have anything to say about that statement?
I thought that was a great statement, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful, but the reason that I had brought it up, aside from the fact that family members are saying that Gitmo, there's no justice to be found at Gitmo, my next question was, do the military trials still permit hearsay evidence, or have they done away with that?
Well, you know, the problem with the military commissions, I mean, it's funny, the only thing that I could take exception to in that whole statement that you read was an alleged 9/11 trial. you know, reaching completion in the military commissions. It was a man named Salim Hamdan, who was a Yemeni guy who had, you know, although he had been introduced to Osama bin Laden, he took a $200 a month paid job as one of seven drivers for Osama bin Laden. You know, this was the lowliest level in which you could be operating. He had no knowledge of 9/11 or any kind of operational capacity. The analogies were made at the time, actually, of I don't recall after World War II anybody trying to put Hitler's chauffeur in the dock. You know, so Salim Hamdan, you know, was absolutely not involved in anything in any way that could be described as being a war crime. He just drove a car occasionally for somebody who was perceived as a very bad man. But you know, the problem with the military commissions is that the job of the prosecutors is to hide all knowledge of torture from being exposed by the defense teams, and the job of the defense teams trying to do their job properly is to expose all the evidence to light so that a fair judgment can be reached. It means that what's happening in those in the high profile cases in the military commissions is that they're kind of stuck endlessly in pretrial hearings where these two sides are bouncing arguments between themselves, which can't really be resolved. Almost all the cases that have been resolved in the military commissions, and there aren't many of them, only two have actually gone to trial. The favored route, when the United States can do it, is to reach plea deals, because then they avoid the uncomfortable business of actually having to deal with a proper court proceedings and evidence, and they just get somebody to sign a piece of paper saying, "I did whatever you said it was, and you tell me that I can go home quite soon," which is what's been happening in a number of cases. It's a disgustingly broken system. It's a great shame that the Obama administration didn't stick to their word on holding the trials in New York City. Eric Holder, you know, stood up and made that statement and was then humiliated by his boss when Obama backed down, when a bunch of, I think, opportunistic people decided to portray the government as weak on national security, endangering people by proposing that these terrorists should be tried on the U.S. mainland.
I
think that's because...
I'm sorry, just going to say, I just saw that a conviction took place, I think, in New York City for a terrorist. I mean, there was no outcry then.
No, there's not. I mean, the problem is that, you know, there is an interest that certain people have, you know, in the Republican Party, on Fox News, all of these kind of people, to stir things up when the word Guantanamo is mentioned. Guantanamo is a different kind of terrorist to any other kind of terrorist. They're ones who must make people shake in their boots. Now, you know, I know that part of the reason for this is that there are certain forces within U.S. society who like having a bunch of people held at Guantanamo without charge or trial, or caught up in these interminable pretrial hearings that may never get anywhere, who are effectively all in the same boat. They're held without due process by the United States, possibly forever. And there are people who like that. They like that power. They like the vengeance that comes with it, because they think these are the guys who did it, and they like sending a message to the American people and to the world of we are the toughest people that you are ever going to encounter. Don't think there is anybody tougher than us, because look what we do. We don't need these pansy rules that we used to have. Now we say that these are bad guys, we put them away, and we hold them there forever. You know, you better believe it, baby.
I've always thought that the reasons that they didn't want these in federal court was not only because of torture, but because of other information that could come out publicly, because it's a public setting. You have to face cross-examination. You have to provide evidence. You have to go through all of these things. I mean, there are many questions about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He had ties to the Pakistani ISI. I never hear about that. Which seems to be a theme.
I mean, who knows, John, to be honest, but I don't think that that's the main reason. I think that, you know, I think that it's to keep people scared, and it's people who are trying to keep the American people scared, and also trying to say that they're the big protector, But in fact, what they're doing is they're reveling in the ability to imprison people that they've portrayed as bad guys without any proof, without any form of due process whatsoever. And you know, there are other aspects of the story, obviously, that you know that could be of interest were it to come to trial. But I actually think that if they if tomorrow they said, actually, forget it, we're canning the merger commissions, we're moving these guys to federal court, there wouldn't be that much transparency. All that would happen is the prosecutors would come up with a minimum amount of information that could be regarded as untainted, establishing that these were the people who did what they said they did, and boy, the all-American jury would convict. I honestly think that would happen. You know, because in so many other terrorism cases, John, we haven't actually seen, the exposure of the truth. We've seen people going through the motions. I mean, you know, it's not as though the judicial process is something that is necessarily fair. Depending on, you know, what's being dealt with, people don't get dealt with fairly.
There are many problems with our federal courts.
Yeah, and I mean, it's too late, you know, it's too late to undo the torture that took place. I don't know what is the best solution in these cases. What interests me more is that, you know, what we haven't had is a thorough repudiation of torture. We haven't had the required message to be sent out to the American people and to the American establishment that it was wrong, which is that people high up who ordered it are prosecuted.
One of the biggest problems in this country is a lack of accountability in government. And a government that is not accountable, as we have learned, is an extremely dangerous government.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Do you know any of the defense lawyers for the 9/11 5? And what have they told you about how legitimate the legal proceedings are?
Well, you know, I have met a few of them over the years, John, but, you know, they aren't really allowed to talk about anything. This is the kind of main point that I think a lot of people would be very shocked to discover. Now, when it comes to Guantanamo, you know, it took lawyers 2.5 years to, or nearly 3 years, to get into the prison to meet people that they were going to represent. And, you know, and what happens when a lawyer meets a prisoner? From the very beginning, it's been the same. They take handwritten notes of their discussions with the prisoner, and then every word is presumptively classified. What they then have to do is they then have to submit them to a Pentagon review process where somebody working in this office somewhere decides whether these notes can be unclassified or whether they must remain classified. And over the years, what we've seen is that actually a lot of information has come out about Guantanamo through this process that a proper fascist state wouldn't be allowing any of it out. But, you know, the residue or maybe it's more than the residue, the elements of the checks and balances that exist within the U.S. system have meant that over the years, you know, a lot of disturbing information about Guantanamo has come out through things
Absolutely.
Being unclassified. The important thing to remember about the high-value detainees, so these are the 14 guys who, you know, had spent years in most cases in CIA black sites before they got to Guantanamo in September 2006, is that not a single word any of these guys have ever uttered to their lawyers has been unclassified. Not a word. Everything has remained classified. And
well,
why would that be?
Question.
Well, that would be because these are the guys who were tortured, you know. It's obviously deeply infuriating for the lawyers who are involved in trying to represent these people, because, you know, there you go. There's an example of how the system remains rigged or broken, or however you choose to describe it. But it's not a fair system.
Well, there are so many examples. You know, I monitor the news, and I monitor what goes on at Guantanamo Bay, and it seems like every other week there's some new kind of scandal taking place at Guantanamo with
yeah.
regards to the military commissions. I remember
yeah,
when the lawyers...
Yeah, because they were, you know... Yeah.
The lawyers were saying that they were being bugged by the CIA
and
so forth, and I just heard that they were trying to force the judges to live on...
the base and to get these trials underway, to force them to get these
trials. Well, which is funny, because they then derailed the whole thing.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, honestly, John, yeah, I mean, you're somebody who's paying attention. You know, I've been paying attention, obviously. You know, I started researching and writing about this in 2006. In 2007, when I started writing about it full-time as a journalist, the military commissions had just, you know, stumbled into life again. And, you know, and without exception, they have been, you know, they have been a dark farce from the beginning. I mean, you know, it's funny in a, you know, in a way that's humiliating for the United States establishment that, that you know, that they cannot ever present something, you know, coherent to the world. But, you know, they do. They stumble from one disaster to another. And you know, and over again, something comes out of left field you didn't expect. That, you know, that just yet again, you know, it's humiliating. You know, they are not fit for purpose. They should be scrapped. And, you know, and the seven men who are currently being prosecuted, the only people who are ever going to be prosecuted, I believe, which includes the five men allegedly responsible for the 9/11 attacks, need to be moved to the U.S. mainland. Federal court trials need to be set up for them, and you know, and bring it on.
There are many family members who would love you for what you just said. Now,
well, you know, they have been denied justice for such a long time, John. And you know, the fact is, you know, the fact is that this could all have been avoided if. The Bush administration had not decided to turn America into a torture nation. If these people had been apprehended and had been, you know, had been treated in a humane manner, which, apart from anything else, what we know about some of these guys is that they were happily talking to the FBI, who weren't torturing them, before they were taken off by the CIA and tortured. All of this stuff could have been wrapped up a long time ago. You know.
One thing I wanted to bring up: a lot of people question the statements of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or the admission of guilt with regards to 9/11. And as a matter of fact, before he was captured, he was interviewed by somebody by the name of Yosri Fuda. And some people question that interview, and that's fine. But when Obama came into office and said that he was going to close Guantanamo, that meant that the military commissions were over, essentially. And what they did as a result of that, if I remember correctly, is they actually released a document that showed some of the evidence that they had against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Are you familiar with any of that?
Yeah.
They talked about some computers.
I mean, they didn't say they were going to close down the military commissions. He actually froze them for a while to review them, and then made the unwise decision.
You're right.
To proceed with both federal court trials and military commission trials, which was Eric Holder's announcement, when they should have just had federal court trials, I think. But, you know, and they released information that was, I mean, they released information from the combatant status review tribunals that they had to hold for these guys to make them eligible for military commissions. That, the way the law was set up, you couldn't be put on trial in a military commission before it was decided through a tribunal that you were an enemy combatant. So they had these tribunals for the high value detainees, which, you know, where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed claimed responsibility for everything. I mean, the joke at the time that I remember was that, you know, where's the bit that says that he was on the grassy knoll, because he basically claimed responsibility for everything that had ever happened.
Exactly. Well, the thing was,
which is clearly ridiculous.
What I'm trying to say to people is that he confessed to Yosri Fuda. They had evidence against him, and I've seen some of the evidence.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons I don't entirely take Khalid Sheikh Mohammed out of the 9/11 equation.
Yeah.
So, but the 9/11
you
report.
You also have to.
Well, I was going to say the 9/11 report.
Connection.
I'm sorry?
You've got the Ramzi Youssef connection. I mean, he's his nephew. So, you know, there's some story, you know, whether it involves other players, of course, is a different matter. I entirely agree. But, you know, I mean, I'd love to see it, John. I'd love to see, you know, the merger commissions canned, federal court trials taking place, and, you know, I think that it would be a straightforward manner to convince an all-American jury that these are the bad guys. But, you know, it may be that it would be the opportunity for things to emerge. It would certainly be an opportunity for the opportunity to be created for all of these other possibilities to be aired. You know, in the media, if not in a courtroom, it would open it up. Because the thing about Guantanamo all along has been, this is some funny, shuttered little place, you know, out of sight, out of mind. You know, it doesn't fulfill the requirement of any kind of transparency. It just really doesn't. You know, and federal court trials, while, you know, while hopefully providing some kind of closure for the people who lost, you know, their family members on September 11th, would also, I think, you know, enable us to start to air some of these issues.
Well, that's the thing.
Because
you're
right, you know, you're right. Who is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Who did he know? What's the connection? How come he's related to Ramzi Youssef? What was that about, the 1993 World Trade Center plot? You know, off we go. I mean, you know, that we can go scurrying in all kinds of directions, finding interesting things.
Well, that's the whole point. That's why the families
for
years have wanted this in the courtrooms, and that's one of the reasons
now
they're fighting to get Saudi Arabia into the courtroom, because when you get 9/11 into a courtroom, you find out things that you did not find out from the 9/11 Commission or the Joint Congressional Inquiry and so on and so forth. So that's, you know, the federal courts are not perfect, but they're not as controlled as the military commissions, obviously.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Now, recently it was reported, and this is just something, a personal question. Recently it was reported that the 9/11 5 showed up to proceedings showing Palestinian colors to support Gaza. Now, where did they manage to get these colors? It just seems an awful lot like propaganda to me.
Yeah, it sounds it to me as well. And I actually hadn't come across that story, so I don't know. I mean, you know, it is theoretically possible that they would have asked their lawyers to find them something. But, you know, I can't imagine that if it was actually something that politically charged, that they would have complied with it. I mean, I think it's a different matter from when Binyan Mohammed, who was a British resident, who he was released in 2009, who was briefly, you know, charged in the military commissions. He asked his lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, the founder of Reprieve, for something orange for when he took part in his military commission hearing. They wanted him to look like a normal civilian, and he wanted to make a point that he was a prisoner in this darkly iconic place, and he wanted orange. So, you know, they, Clive, and he was saying, you know, go away and get me a Dutch football shirt, because the Dutch wear orange.
Yeah, right.
You know, and he spent a lot of time trying to be able to make his statement, but of course that, you know, that wasn't anything that was politically contentious that was related to anything other than Guantanamo itself wearing orange.
Wasn't there a time when there was an actual propaganda film made by professional filmmakers shown at the military commissions about 9/11 and so forth?
Oh, I'm sure there would have been. What, an American propaganda film about it?
Yes, I believe so.
I remember stuff like that was shown at the trial of Jose Padilla, who was
the
one of two U.S. citizens who was ever held as an enemy combatant on U.S. soil and tortured. You know, a guy who it seems to be possible to be said of him was that he had traveled to Afghanistan and had put his name down to go to a training camp, but he was tied into a completely fictitious dirty bomb plot. And after he was liberated from the military brig in which he'd been tortured and it was put into the federal court system because George Bush wouldn't try and defend torturing an American on American soil without due process, he had this trial where the jury, I believe, were wearing Stars and Stripes outfits on July the 4th, and they were shown, you know, these huge propaganda films about Osama bin Laden. When, you know, it had nothing to do with Jose Padilla. There was no suggestion that he'd ever met Osama.
Right, that's the story I remember.
Yeah.
Okay. That's just so, it just seems like kangaroo courts are going on. Literally, kangaroo courts.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you know, you remember what happened with John Walker Lind as well, you know, the American Taliban.
Yeah.
You know, a man against whom there is no evidence that he, you know, that he ever took up arms against a fellow American. You know, or David Hicks, for that matter, who's just, you know, the Australian who finally had his military commission conviction overturned. You know, he was an adventurer who had converted to Islam. He later turned against that, but you know, he was in Afghanistan after the U.S.-led invasion, and when they picked him up, they wanted to make an example of him. There was no suggestion that he had ever engaged in combat, had ever, you know, done any harm to any American.
Well, I don't know if you've heard or not, but it was recently announced that ISIS is in every state of the United States right now. So I wonder how many people...
Is that right?
Yeah, it was just announced. I forget by who. I think it was by the FBI director.
Are you sure this, isn't inept people searching the internet and discovering the song by Bob Dylan?
No, this was real. Somebody just said that in every state, ISIS exists. And I can't imagine, you know, a protester or somebody being arrested and called ISIS. I can see that coming, but, you know, we'll see.
Right. Yeah, yeah. We'll see how War on Terror version 2 pans out, John, because that's certainly what's happening here in the UK. Just as it was running out of steam, they're back with a new version.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, unfortunately, ISIS was essentially created by our allies and us and by our actions in the Middle East. You know, as I said, there's no statute of limitations on killing a child, on torturing somebody, on sodomizing somebody, on flushing Korans down the toilet, of having Blackwater hunt you for sport. There's no statute of limitations on the anger these things create. So, of course, there's going to be people in the Middle East that are pissed off at us.
Yeah. No,
and,
I mean,
you know,
absolutely. I agree with you, John. And, you know,
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, you know, they were sending rebels into Syria. We were sending them intelligence. Then we started sending them arms. Then we started sending in rebels of our own from Jordan. And, you know, this whole mess it turned into ISIS, essentially. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely, John. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's depressing to watch it, you know.
Yep.
Because in that sense, you know, although Guantanamo clearly acts as a, you know, as a recruiter, which, you know, on those occasions that President Obama speaks so eloquently about Guantanamo, he recognizes this. You know, to that extent, Guantanamo is kind of doing two things. One is that it's a legacy of something that was established by the Bush administration, which is certainly how Obama theorizes it in a lot of ways. He has never sent someone new there, despite, you know, the cry to do that every time and a terrorist suspect is seized. But, you know, those people who are holding on to Guantanamo somewhere that is, you know, essential for America's safety and are really, really celebrating that, you know, really pushing for it, you know, that those people are obviously sending out a message to people, you know, who are engaged in activities now. But, you know, a lot of the things that are happening, the terrible stuff that you've been talking about that's happening out in the Middle East now, in a lot of ways seems unconnected. So you have this iconic beacon that is Guantanamo in some ways, in an important sense. But the rest of it is, you know, blowback for things that followed on from 9/11 in another way. I mean, how bad was the fallout from the illegal invasion of Iraq that's led so much to the situation that we're in now? Which in some ways, you know, we those of us who were paying attention, were aware of at the time. I remember at the time when, you know, when these idiots dismantled the entire Ba'athist apparatus, you know, put all the Ba'athists out of jobs. It's like, wait a minute, you just destroyed any structure that civil society had. Plus, all these guys are going to be really pissed off with you. You know, and yet these were the people who were the soldiers. This isn't going to go well. And sure enough, you know, that's a position that we're in now, that we're looking at, you know, at ISIS, that, you know, that this is some movement that involves a lot of these people who were dispossessed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion. So, It's horrible. It's horrible to be going round and round in these circles of monstrosity that, you know, it's like, wait a minute, we have to go back in because of something we created in the first place?
Well, what I think is funny is that how it's portrayed in America, because, you know, Obama ended the Iraq war, even though we still had 15,000 people there. We had the largest base there. We had military contractors still there, and so on and so forth. And now they're acting as if now we're 6 months into this new war, as if it's completely unconnected. And it's just absurd to me.
Yeah, no, it's so horrible, isn't it?
Well, my last question to you, and I think this is pretty obvious, do you consider the military commissions to be real justice?
No, absolutely not at all. Not at all, John. I think I've said quite a lot about them in our previous questions, but they, you know, they should never have been resuscitated, you know, by Dick Cheney, who seemed to be the main driver of them. You know, they limped on for a few years until the Supreme Court delivered an absolute, you know, devastating ruling on them, and then Bush got Congress to, you know, to bring them back to life with invented war crimes. You know, the invented war crimes of providing material support to terrorism and conspiracy, which are, you know, criminal. They're crimes that can be prosecuted in federal court, but they're not war crimes. You know, people told them, high-level people said, this isn't going to work. The same when Obama resuscitated them, you know, this isn't going to work. In fact, members of Obama's own administration, high-level lawyers, said, we don't think, you know, particularly providing material support to terrorism is going to stand up on appeal. And that's what's been happening. You know, I don't know how closely people have been watching because, you know, it's not enough of the mainstream narrative in the United States. But, you know, four of the military commission's, you know, handful of rulings have been overturned precisely on this basis, that they were told providing material support to terrorism is not a war crime. It wasn't a war crime when the legislation was passed, and it isn't a war crime. It's not recognized as one. Congress invented it, essentially, and it's been falling on appeal. So the whole thing is unraveling terribly. But like I say, I don't genuinely think that you know, the majority of Americans have any idea about this. You know, every now and then there'll be a tiny bit of coverage in the media as another one of these rulings bites the dust. You know, most recently it was David Hicks. But I don't think people are really seeing, you know, the extent to which this entire system has been judged to be a sham. Every time they have one of those 9/11 pre-trial hearings where, you know, some other farce happens, it really is, you know, it's actually embarrassing. I think it should be embarrassing to the American people, John.
It certainly is to me, but unfortunately the corporate media in this country does not cover things as they should. Which was one of the reasons I tried to get you on board with saying that we were lied to about 9/11, because you have a voice, and, you know, when the corporate media doesn't work, you have to rely on those with a voice to tell people what's going on. And that's what you've done with Guantanamo, and I thank you very much for everything you've written over the years. It's been very helpful to me, at least. The military commissions, I just want to say, are a huge slap in the face to the 9/11 family members. It's not justice. It's not justice. There can never be real justice at Guantanamo Bay. And I feel so sorry for all of the families, and I hope that things change and that we get 9/11 into a real courtroom.
Absolutely.
Is there anything you would like to promote at this time?
Well, you know, I just I hope people have been listening to this. I hope that they have, you know, that they're trying to understand all the facts about Guantanamo, not the lies and the distortions that they've been told over the years. I obviously, you know, would very much love people to come to my website, andyworthington.co.uk, where, you know, there are thousands of articles that I've written over the last 8 years about Guantanamo. to join up with the Close Guantanamo campaign. That's closeguantanamo.org that I established a few years ago with my lawyer friend Tom Wilner, who argued the Guantanamo cases in the Supreme Court. And my most recently established campaign, which is We Stand With Shaka, for Shaka Armour, which is spelled Shaker, but Shaka Armour is the last British resident in Guantanamo. He appears to be held solely because he is basically, you know, big-mouthed and combative. He has resisted the injustice of the war on terror from the word go, and they're afraid that he'll embarrass them if released. He's been cleared for release in 2007 and in 2009. He's still there. WeStandWithShaka.org is that website, and we've been encouraging people to send in photos of themselves holding up signs that say, I stand with Shaka. If people want to do that, that would be great. And it's just, you know, if you get it, if you understand that, you know, not only the commissions we've been talking about that are a betrayal of justice, but that holding people indefinitely without charge or trial is not only fundamentally un-American, it flies in the face of justice. We are in both of our countries, John, brought up to believe that we respect the rule of law. And, you know, the kind of number one thing that you have to do is that you can't, you know, throw people in prison without a trial, unless it's wartime and you're holding them officially as soldiers protected by the Geneva Conventions, which isn't what's happening here. You know, it's a danger for all of us that, you know, that, hey, it's 13 years of alleged Muslim terrorists, but, you know, who would it be next? If you allow these people to imprison people without charge or trial, you know, it could be some other group of people next. It's fundamentally wrong, and it shouldn't happen. And really, you know, although I have researched the stories of these individual people and I've come to, you know, to be concerned, you know, on a human basis of some of the people whose stories I've come across, fundamentally, you know, it isn't just about these individuals, although that is important because we've been told that they are not human, that they should be not thought of as human beings. But it is those principles that are at stake, and you know, and that's why I'm still here working to stop indefinite detention without charge or trial from carrying on, because it's a threat to everything that we hold dear.
Well, I thank you very much, and I just wanted to point out to people with regards to the 9/11 5 that, you know, there is no justice, there can be no justice, and I can't say anything more than that, at Guantanamo. And that's, I wanted to show people, you know, when we're told that there is justice in Guantanamo Bay, that is a lie. That's one of the lies of 9/11, as far as I'm concerned. But I wanted people to know that. All right, Andy, I want to thank you very much for your time tonight. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, John.
I wish you luck in all of your future endeavors.
Yes, and to you. Thanks.
And keep up the good work, please.
Okay, John. Cheers. Good night.
All right, take care, Andy.